Very good book, by the way. And he's a professor of laboratory assessment at the University of Bridgeport. How are you today, Michael?
I'm good, Gary.
Good. Michael, I always give my guests an opportunity when I challenge a topic with a great deal of intensity and passion, an opportunity to challenge it in return, since I don't want anyone to feel that any of my guests should support my particular views. They may have their own on the topic. So it's your turn for a few moments to attack or challenge anything I just said.
Well, Gary, I have to say that, I've read much of the material that you've presented, and I must admit, even based on my traditional, training and laboratory training, that we're, whether we are chiropractors or medical doctors or naturopaths, a lot of the information we get is, a lot of it is the status quo as well, and we may not have recognized initially on some of the actual facts that you just spoke about the dogma, misinformation, and problem regarding AIDS, HIV, and just testing. So overall, when I consider some of what you've said and what I've read, I would have to say overwhelmingly that I do agree. I think that the only concern that I do have is, and I open this question up to you, is because we want to foster proactive individuals educating themselves and making decisions, how can the average individual make sense of a lot of the information? I think I know some of the answer there, but I'm still faced with the dilemma that a very intelligent person may not be able to get through a lot of the technical information. Of course, a lot of the things that you're producing are more readable, but for a good amount of people, the information is just difficult to understand. And I need to ask you.
Okay, what I've done is, in the white paper, I have taken every single issue on AIDS, and I have first referenced it scientifically. There are over 3,000 references, boiled down from 9,000, because some of them were repetitive. I then take what is a hard scientific reality, understanding, for instance, the PCR and what it means, and I put it into lay language in an essay form. So this way people can take very large concepts and understand them because it's in essay form. I then took the manuscript, which was complete 4 weeks ago, and I sent it out to 67 critics and asked them to tear it to pieces. And most but not all did, and they returned with their comments, which I was very appreciative of. Mind you, these are not my supporters or people who believe in this concept.
Right.
And many of their thoughts were very objective and well-reasoned, and I appreciated that input. So I then had an opportunity to correct some things that I had not done enough depth on, that they felt there was not enough of an argument to really substantiate a new point of view. So I strengthened certain areas that they found weak and resubmitted it. They then felt that those arguments were strong enough. This whole process is completed, and now it's in final review by two other independent virologists and microbiologists. I have to go through this process because one of the very first things you should do in any investigation is disprove yourself. Put your best arguments up and then say, all right, these are my arguments, these are my beliefs, these are my hypotheses or my feelings. Are they legitimate? Because as often as not, they're not. And then after you have tried your best to discredit yourself, then let others have an opportunity to. And see if, in the best effort, they can. If they can, then you know you have weaknesses. Better to find out your weaknesses now than to go public with something, only to have it shot full of holes, and then not only you, but the people who believed in you or that particular principle end up being, let's say, disenfranchised from your position, disempowered. So this is something that we do, I've always done, with everything I do, whether it's a cookbook or this white paper, even the fluoride paper. And that way, when it finally does come out, people can have some strong sense of confidence that all of the orthodox arguments have been addressed.
Yes.
So I've made it all into lay language. The documentary is clearly into lay language. It was shot in 37 countries, from Ukraine, and which used to be a part of Russia, and Kiev, to Africa, in 17 different villages in Africa, all over Africa, in South America, and Brazil, and Sweden, everywhere where there was someone who had something important to say or an important challenge to offer, Perth, Australia, the entire group of Eleni Papadopoulos, Eleopoulos, those people who are, they are intellectual heavyweights, far smarter than any of the people that were holding the position HIV as the sole cause, the single cause of AIDS. So you give everyone an opportunity. You put up the arguments, then you see, can you deconstruct them? It's that simple. And if you can't, then you have to honor the fact that you have an argument that you, like it or not, politically or not, emotionally or not, there's something you should pay attention to. And if we're really being objective, we have to honor the fact that if someone has something that we may disapprove of, but it because it doesn't match our point of view, but if they have the facts on their side, then you gotta honor that. You gotta surrender the ego and surrender the need to be right and look at what is right. So that's what this whole process is. Now, I'm bringing in over 50 different scientists and dissidents from around the world for a two-week teaching seminar that'll be almost 12 hours a day, so people can come and take lessons on every single part of it. Like, there'll be 9 different virologists who will talk about HIV not even existing. And these are qualified people. These are not lay people. These are people who their whole careers in this area. So if you hear a whole panel of them discussing it, and you come saying, "Well, that's stupid. That's ridiculous. We have a, of course, HIV exists." All right. Well, then listen to what they have to say. Look at their evidence. Then go back and compare the original beliefs and the original evidence that Gallo brought forward. And you'll be amazed. I mean, this is heavy stuff here.
And once you accomplish that,
Gary, I'm bringing all these people here to New York for 2 weeks, and I feel that it's time. Now, of course, we are going to do as much as we can to get the public to come and challenge. The idea is come and challenge. You should have open forums where you can challenge. And so we'll be encouraging that. But at the same time, after people have had a chance to challenge, then listen to the responses, and if the responses are factual and reasonable, hopefully some minds will change. And I'm sending a copy of the documentary to every media person in the country, every legislator in the country of both local and state and federal government, over 5,000 documentaries, copies I'm making to send to these people. I'm sending it to every church and synagogue and mosque in the country. That'll be over 35,000 of those. Now, this is just let people know. Here's information. You can believe or disbelieve, but you don't know this. And this is the first time this has all been presented, and it's gone through 15 years of a lot of litmus tests. Take a look at it. So I'm going to do everything I can to get us to reappraise AIDS. And that's all this is about. It's just reappraising it so the next drug, the next vaccine, the next test pregnant women, the next everybody who goes to school must be tested. You see where our mindset goes, and you see how they do it, and you don't have to have a high IQ to figure all this out, that the pharmaceutical company is behind all this and its friends who ultimately benefit by going to work for these people. And I even have a chapter in there on the conflict of interest, the people who should have been protecting our interest indeed have lined right up behind the pharmaceutical interest. So that's where it's going.
Thanks for that response, Gary.
Now, let's go to detoxification.
Okay.
Take us on A to Z on that journey, all right, Michael?
Very good. Which seems to pale in comparison to this discussion, but of course it doesn't because, for reasons that I'll discuss now. I'm going to run through this material rather quickly because of time constraints, so I'll quickly give a number where people can get about 15 pages of notes for no cost. They can just call 914-241-7030 and ask for the detox notes. So, Gary, as you know, today we recognize that although the body is designed to eliminate toxins, it can't always handle the overload present in our environment. So toxic overload, of course, can lead to a variety of health problems, everything from headaches to muscle and joint pain, chronic fatigue, allergies, autoimmune disease, just to name a few. In fact, toxicity in general can create any problem. And the basic reason for that is because the process of detoxification, which I'll define in a minute, takes place in every single cell of every single tissue of our bodies. You know, we tend to speak about detoxification or the process of detoxing as occurring in the liver or the intestine, and this is very true. But every one of us detoxes 24 hours a day. But there are things that we can do and various lifestyles that we can adapt or improve upon that enhance our body's ability to detoxify just more efficiently in a toxic world. And to function optimally, our detoxification processes are dependent upon adequate levels of supporting nutrients, including what are known as macronutrients like proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, and micronutrients like vitamins and minerals. And they're depleted during our normal course of aging, and I put quotations around normal. I think few of us actually age normally, and based on a variety of other stressors in the environment, whether they be emotional or physical or electromagnetic. So basically, we know that detoxification takes place in every tissue and every organ, and there are a bunch of things I'm going to discuss right now which we can adapt more or less, given the types of people we are and what we're willing to do, to add up to something over time. So, in other words, some of us might choose to add juicing into our lives, and others may not do that for whatever reasons, but might decide to eat a larger variety of raw vegetables. So whatever we do choose, if it's done each day or pretty much each day, over time does add up, and it adds up to feeling better and a lowered chronic degenerative disease risk due to enhanced and improved detoxification. So a toxin, first of all, let's start with that. Simply speaking, is something that our body has that is causing degenerative changes. It's either gotten from the outside, what's known as an exogenous toxin, which we'll define, and also endogenous toxins, those things that our body produces, which in and of themselves are toxic. And the combined load of those toxins from the outside, along with toxins from the inside, cause a state of toxicity, which can look like any symptom or chronic disease that you can mention. Remember, diseases are basically terms. The diagnosis is a term put on a person when they have a variety of symptoms that are pigeonholed into this or that disease. But the fallacy in all that is, fundamentally, there are problems with detoxification. So, again, we see that the benefit of detox is far-reaching. So why should we be concerned about the body's ability to detox in the first place? Because now more than ever, we're exposed to a myriad of foreign chemicals, both commercially synthesized and naturally occurring in our environment. There's a report, Gary, known as the Kellogg Report, which I know you've heard of, that states that about 1,000 newly synthesized chemicals are introduced each year, which amounts to 3 new chemicals a day. And the current number of known what are called xenotoxins or foreign chemicals, that's an important word to know, xenotoxins, now totals around 100,000, which includes drugs and pesticides and industrial chemicals, food additives, and various environmental pollutants. And to provide some just real examples quickly of just how much poison we are exposed to each year, consider the following statistics from the Toxic Release Inventory National Report. There were approximately 551 million pounds of industrial chemicals dumped into public sewage storage. Close to 2 billion pounds of chemicals were released into the ground, threatening our natural aquifers. And close to 2 million pounds of chemicals were discharged into surface waters. Over 2 billion pounds of air emissions were pumped into the atmosphere. We can go on and on. So it's inarguable that we need to pay attention to detoxification. Our body simply cannot do it anymore. Even the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, estimates that a grand total of something close to 6 billion pounds of chemical pollutants were released into the environment in 1989. So imagine the amounts we're getting. Haven't looked at the newer numbers, but they must be far beyond that right now. So toxic chemicals easily find their way into our bodies through the air we breathe, the food we eat, and the water we drink. We also ingest foreign chemicals when taking medicinal or illicit drugs or when using alcohol or tobacco. And again, although the body is designed to eliminate toxins, it cannot always handle the overload present in today's environment. Now, but toxins, as I said, don't just come from external sources, which are, again, called exotoxins. They're also produced within the body. So if we can maximize the foods that we're taking in and nutrients and supplements, for example, we can reduce the production of these endotoxins. And we do that by reducing their formation in the first place and by enhancing our liver, our intestine, our fat tissues, ability, or all of our cells' ability to get rid of them. So let me speak about some of the symptoms and things that we might, the consequences of toxicity. First of all, when the body experiences an overload of toxic substances, it could show up as I said earlier, headaches, muscle, joint pain, fatigue, irritability, depression, or even just brain fog, variety of gastrointestinal problems, cardiovascular problems, flu-like symptoms, allergic reactions, you know, and all the little things we consider like minor symptoms, like stuffy and runny noses, coughing. These could be, and most likely are, symptoms that the body is either not healing properly, particularly if someone has made no efforts to eat well or to take supplements or to do things with a detoxification mindset. So in addition to those sorts of symptoms, it's been suggested that toxic overload contributes to what we consider more serious problems like autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, lupus, psoriasis, migraines, all autoimmune, and various types of neurological diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, very well recognized now to be related to at least heavy metals, not to mention many other varieties of chemicals found in the foods that most of us are consuming in terms of our plant products. So why don't I run through quickly here, and I have a wonderful chart that I'll send people, of specific nutrients. I'm going to list them.
Okay, but go slow enough so people can write these things down.
Yes.
Okay, Michael?
I will. Now, before I do that, I want people to recognize that, give you a little bit more detail. The whole concept of detoxification, and we'll talk about the liver here for a minute, but these concepts apply to every tissue. There are two phases of detoxification in the body, phase one and phase two. And both of these phases are equally important. And it's, again, important to know that because once I review the nutrients for each, you might realize in your intake that you might be taking in too much of certain nutrients which speed up one process of detoxification maybe more than another, and you may want to balance things out somewhat. So when the body is exposed to toxins, whether we make them ourselves or they're from the environment, these toxins generally are stored in fat tissue in the body, and they're known as lipid-soluble. They get stored in fat. For example, the prostate gland is largely composed of fatty tissue, the brain, the spinal cord, the breast tissue. So this, of course, explains a lot of the associated disease in those particular tissues. So the body needs to take these fat-soluble toxins, and it needs to turn them into a water-soluble form of that so the kidneys can excrete it, and also the bile and through the feces and the urine. If you can't get it out, just mobilizing the toxins in the body and having them have no place to go is a problem. So phase one detoxification is where the body takes these fat-soluble toxins and pushes them towards what are called an intermediate phase, and then the body then turns them into a water-soluble form in phase two detoxification. And these aren't made-up terms in holistic medicine. These are the actual types of terms used in histology books and toxicology books to describe actual detoxification. So phase one, let's talk about the nutrition, where the body's taking those fat-soluble toxins and tries to need these nutrients to move them towards phase two. So we need the B vitamins, particularly B2, vitamin B3, B6, folic acid, B12. We need the amino acid glutathione, very, very important immune modulator, and various branched-chain amino acids. Those are things like isoleucine, that's isoleucine, leucine, and valine. These have particular effects, all of these nutrients I'm describing, on taking fat-soluble toxins and changing their structure, their chemical structure, so the body can get rid of them. Also, flavonoids from plants. These are the main ones. And the body needs these nutrients as partners with different enzymes in the body, which again, turn those fat-soluble toxins to water-soluble toxins. So these nutrients are known as cofactors, and they're absolutely essential. If we have these nutrients in adequate amounts, then the body will take toxins and turn them into these intermediate chemicals. Now, here's the problem. If you have all these wonderful nutrients that turns that fat-soluble toxin into this intermediate chemical, and you don't have enough of the next set of nutrients, your body will be stuck in that intermediate phase. And those toxins are now more toxic in that intermediate phase than they initially were in your body. Let me say that again. You take toxins in and your body makes them. They're fat-soluble. The body has to turn them into these intermediate toxins with those nutrients I just listed. If you don't have enough of the next set of nutrients, you get stuck there. Your body's done half the process, and it's more toxic than the original toxins. So what do we need, first of all, during this intermediate phase to move nutrients into phase two? What we need for this intermediate phase are the more common antioxidants that people have heard of. The carotenes from carrots, like beta carotene as an example. Vitamin C or ascorbic acid. We need vitamin E, selenium, and we also need certain minerals and metals like copper and zinc, manganese, coenzyme Q10, bioflavonoids, again from plants, silymarin, which is milk thistle, very, very important liver detoxifier, and there's also something called pycnogenol. That's P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L. Those set of nutrients, which are antioxidants and plant-derived nutrients, can move things from that intermediate phase to phase two. And phase two allows things to become water-soluble for elimination. And what's interesting is that there were many, many, many different phases in this phase two. I'm not going to go into all of them other than to say they depend on the following amino acids. They're very heavily amino acid dependent. N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, that many of us have heard about, or cysteine. You can get it in two forms. I like the N-acetylcysteine better for detox. And then there's the amino acid glycine, and also taurine, glutamine, orthanine, and arginine. Those are the things essentially needed so the body can take fat-soluble toxins, convert them into those intermediate toxins, and then the intermediate goes into phase two. With the presence of these amino acids, there is a process known as conjugation, and then these things can be eliminated and excreted through the serum, again, the urine, and the feces. That's a detailed sort of summary of that. Now, what we're here to talk about is what are the essential components of a detoxification program, because many of you will read and participate in them. Well, the first thing is you want to have some knowledge about some of the details we just spoke about. And I think also any detox program should have various questionnaires be completed so you can all see, based on your different body systems and what your symptoms are, how you improve over time. So some sort of health appraisal questionnaire should be used. I also think it's important to record your efforts, the foods and fluids or various methods and symptoms that come up on an activity sheet where, again, each day you're writing down what you ate, how you felt, things of that nature, so when you look back later, you can identify things rather than having some vague notion that this or that food or activity or stress was good or bad for you. This is a learning process, so a detox program usually lasts several weeks or even longer. And remember, a detox program, I'd like to think of that as a boot camp. In other words, it's a focused education and practical approach to get your body doing something that it may not do on its own, given the years of stress it's undergone, or if many of you have participated very well in terms of handling your health. But again, we realize based on the description of the toxins in our environment that we just cannot get rid of without some special effort. So when we talk about, I have a list that I'll give people about these toxins in the environment, specific ones. Again, I'll just run down them quickly again. The cigarette smoke and the alcohol and caffeine and various types of medication and MSG and aspartame and pesticides, all these things we need to deal with. And those are from our environment. But again, our body makes toxins, even our natural steroid production in our body. When the body uses up steroids and uses up cholesterol and all of these other things, they're put in the bowel, the body needs to get rid of them, and if it can't get rid of them, they get sucked right back in the system. And not only is that inherently toxic, but that confuses your entire physiology. Your body then says, oh, well, these other hormones are coming back, and this cholesterol is coming back, and these toxins, and the gut becomes irritated and inflamed, and the ecology of the intestine is offset. So this is what we're dealing with. And there are specific foods for certain individuals that might support detoxification. So the first thing I'll say about that is I'm going to go down a list right now, and some of these foods are appropriate for lots of people. If you're allergic to these foods, I would say they're not appropriate for you. Now, if they make you feel worse when you eat them, that doesn't necessarily mean they're bad for you. They might actually be enhancing the very process of detoxification, and sometimes people get symptoms. So an important point to remember is any detoxification program will probably warn you that you may, in fact, feel quite bad at certain points during the detoxification program, and we want to make sure that whoever the instructor is, they can help you distinguish for yourself whether or not these are symptoms of toxicity or symptoms of a problem. So some of the foods that are specifically good for detox and clearing are, of course, raw vegetables and fruits, the insoluble fibers like beans and legumes and whole grains, and, of course, the vegetables and fruits. And then the water-soluble fibers, pears, apples, oat bran, legumes, and things like garlic and onions and watercress, mustard, horseradish, cabbage, broccoli. These are things that are very good for detoxification. They're loaded with the types of nutrients we specifically mentioned earlier that support the various phases of detoxification, and there are many, many other reasons why they work, which we'll probably never know. So nature has lots of answers. But on the other hand, there are foods that congest the body and actually inhibit detoxification, things like red meat and dairy products and eggs in many instances, and even tofu can with certain individuals. Roasted nuts and seeds as opposed to raw, which are far, far more healthy. And again, if you have an allergy to certain foods or a sensitivity, that might be something that's inhibiting detoxification for you as an individual. The other thing is a very basic concept. Whenever we do a detoxification program, sometimes you get bogged down in all of these things to learn, and that's, of course, important. And we forget some of the basic things, like chewing carefully. It's not enough to just chomp down your food a couple of times, but we want to really liquefy our foods in our mouth, so we have the body prepare, the digestive system prepare, and emotionally prepare for the foods entering our body. So, again, it's digested better, and we get much more nutrition out of it. If we're gulping down our foods and taking in a lot of air, well, we can get gas as a result of that, and then we have chronic gas, and we go to the gastroenterologist, and they put you on one of several medications to take care of your gas rather than say to you, just slow down and chew your food. Also, simply drinking too much fluid at a meal, that could dilute your digestive juices. And your digestive juices contain various enzymes and acids, which you do need to digest. So don't drink too much liquid at your meals. And for some people, they may not notice a big problem or any problem with drinking fluids, but you may want to consider experimenting with that during a focused detox program. You might be surprised what a difference that makes in your energy. Eating too fast. These are just basic things. We don't want to eat too fast for, I think, obvious reasons. And we want to avoid eating when we're under stress, because when we are stressed, our body's in a very sympathetic hyper mode, and that's meant for a fight or flight, you know, running around response, and it's not meant for the type of relaxative, what's known as a parasympathetic sort of state where your body can digest very, very well. So just the basics of just, you know, paying attention to how you're putting food in your mouth and what you're doing with it. I think any detoxification program would be incomplete if it didn't have a detailed discussion and practical use of juicing and a discussion of the benefits of juicing. First of all, juicing allows for concentrated forms of those wonderful ingredients in nature's plants, easily assimilated vitamins, minerals, enzymes, and phytochemicals and fiber to a certain extent. I like to promote juicing for the juicing and not for its fiber content, and focus on eating raw and lightly cooked vegetables and fruits for the fiber. So I like to juice for the concentrated juice itself. And there are many, many types of different fruit juice combinations and many wonderful books. But I like to, in the morning, for example, I'll take a couple of carrots. I'll take an apple, I'll use cabbage and dark greens, beets, mix them up all together, maybe a little bit of ginger.
Are you receiving me?
Do you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. I heard someone in the background, Gary. So the point here is that there are various types of juice combinations for even a person's particular symptoms. So I would strongly recommend that you consult a book on juicing, or again, any detoxification course should really go through a general review of what's good to juice and probably what's not so good to juice. Not that they're not unhealthy to juice, but for example, it's difficult to juice a papaya or a coconut, but certainly they're healthy. And it's easier to juice, you know, apples and carrots and things of that nature. Now, a detoxification course should also speak about what are just some simple, basic snack options, because in my experience, many people that go through courses can get a bit overwhelmed at the amount of information, and then it comes back to the basics. Well, what do I eat for breakfast, for goodness sakes? So that's a very important thing where we want to just think of some simple snack options. Like, again, we can snack on fresh fruits and vegetables. And for most of you listening, this is romper room ABCs. But to the average individual who has not attempted this, this is very profound information. I like to promote also dehydrated fruits and vegetables, so they're easy to carry. And there are inexpensive dehydrators that one could purchase, and you can carry these concentrated, delicious, sweet snacks along. And by eating these types of things throughout the course of the day, several small little meals throughout the day, as opposed to our, you know, two or three big meal sort of mentality, we'll have better digestion, we'll get greater nutritional value out of the food, we'll help better balance a steady blood sugar throughout the course of the day. So there's, again, snacking on fruits and vegetables, the dehydrated fruits and vegetables. Fruit smoothies are wonderful. And two fruit smoothies, one could add either a protein mix or they can add extra nutrients into that. And these are just good, basic things to do.
That's good information, Michael.
Thank you.
And people want to get this?
Yeah, and I just went through a small amount, but they can give us a call at 914-241-7030, and they could just ask for the detox notes, and we'll send them right out, Gary.
Appreciate you being on.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Dr. Michael Wald. Now, in the 12 minutes we have remaining, see if we can disconnect Michael. Phone there. And ask our... There we are. Let me bring you some additional health and nutrition update information. This comes from Celia Hall, medical editor. Study links aspirin to risk of miscarriage. A group of painkillers, which includes aspirin and ibuprofen, have been linked to an increased risk of miscarriage. Two studies into the effects of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs contradict other work, which has suggested that aspirin may be help to reduce the risk of miscarriage. This actually increases it, according to Dr. Gunnar Nielsen from Otter Hospital in Denmark, who led the new studies, and it was published in the British Medical Journal. Quote, as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are widely used, even a small increase in the risk of adverse effects may have major implications for public health, unquote. The researchers found that miscarriages were most likely to occur when women had taken the drugs in the preceding week. The death of the fetus usually happens sometime before it's discovered, so it could be women are taking drugs to relieve the pain of the miscarriage that they are not aware of. This is the first study of its kind, so at the moment we do not know what comes first, the hen or the egg. Women included in the research were all taking painkillers prescribed by their doctors. And so for all the people out there, when you consider that about one in three pregnancies ends up in miscarriage, be very careful, because that's another thing that we shouldn't be doing. And by the way, it's not surprising that the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories could cause miscarriage. They caused 16,400 people to die last year just from taking for arthritis alone. This comes from Julie McMeehan from Health Scout Reporter. Iron problems may lead to Parkinson's. Genetic engineering that knocks out an iron-regulating protein caused Parkinson's-like diabetes in research. The finding is key to understanding development of brain disease that affects movement, said the senior study investigator Dr. Tracy Rolott, chief of the section on human iron metabolism at the National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development. While scientists had long observed that patients with these diseases build up iron deposits in the brain, no one was sure whether the deposits cause the disease or a byproduct of the cell death that resulted from the disease. Quote, we demonstrated that an inherited iron regulation protein mutation can be the cause of deterioration of the brain in animals. The mistake in the iron metabolism causes physical degeneration, and the iron accumulation is a sign of that mistake, unquote. That was published in Nature Genetics. This comes from Elizabeth Piper and from Reuters. Now, this is something I had mentioned a long time ago, probably about a year ago. I tried to interview this gentleman. I have not been successful in getting him to do an interview yet, but I am working on it. This is a follow-up to an earlier set of programs, I think seven programs we did on mad cow disease. Mark Purdy still eats beef, even junk, in pies and hamburgers, and he has no fear that he or his wife or six children will be struck down by the deadly human form of mad cow disease. Quote, it's an absolute myth, unquote, the 48-year-old organic farmer says, banging his fist on a large wooden table to underline his argument that much of the accepted logic on bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE, is wrong. His story unfolds, a 16-year campaign to explore the effects of organophosphates, the chemicals he believes are behind the spread of brain-wasting disease in cattle and in people. Purdy says we should distance ourselves from, quote, the men in bow ties, unquote, who have what he calls a monopoly on thought. Forget the role of tainted animal feed in spreading BSE among cattle or infected meat in passing the disease to humans as new variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Look instead at the use of synthetic organophosphates derived from military nerve gas, which the UK agricultural minister told farmers to pour along the spine of their cattle in the early 1980s to kill a parasite called the warble fly, and those used in sprays used in Britain's countryside. Quote, I have been hammering the establishment theory, the so-called meat and bone meal theory, since 1988 or 1989. Even then, I had identified that meat and bone meal have been sold all over the world, particularly the Middle East. If you're blaming this stuff and you're sending it all over the world, why on earth aren't you getting more BSE? Unquote. He agrees that other scientists would argue that it has yet to appear because of the long incubation period of the disease, believed to be caused by a mutated prion protein in the brain. But Purdy argues that there is little logic in the theory. He also disputes the argument that BSE is passed to humans via infected beef. He says, if it was to do so by eating beef, we'd have lots of cases in towns where most burger bars are, but 60% of the cases are in rural areas. Most victims live by fields where crops are sprayed. A self-taught scientist, Purdy says he acted first on intuition, refusing to treat his 60 cows with the organophosphate called Phosphomet, and going on to win a court battle with the agriculture ministry to make his point. When BSE was first detected in a British herd in 1986, he immediately thought Phosphomet was the problem, a theory which, after years of unpaid research, has now won respect from senior scientists, public health officials, and politicians. He says, like most things, it was instinct. Being a farmer, I was horrified when I was approached by a ministry official to treat a cow for warble fly by pouring this chemical all along the spinal cord and the base of the head. It was an oil designed to seep through the skin and to change the entire internal environment of the cow into a poisonous medium to kill off the parasites. Purdy began to trowel through books and do field research. He looked at the clusters of BSE in Britain, clusters of deer and elk in the United States with a similar illness called chronic wasting disease, and villages where many people were dying of the more common Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. He says, I went on the road, and I went to the United States, Slovakia, Calabria, and Italy, and Iceland. To me, it was clearly something in the environment that was igniting these illnesses, but what was the factor? He found one common factor, high levels of manganese, a metal given to cattle in high doses via the organophosphate. What I found in the environment was supported in the laboratory, according to Dr. David Brown, a neurobiologist at Cambridge University. Purdy explains the prion would normally bond with copper and carry it around the brain to destroy free radicals. But if lacking copper, the prion bonds with another metal, manganese, which stops the protein from folding properly. He did soil analysis on the areas near clusters of mad cow disease in Britain and found high levels of manganese from crop spraying. He concluded the doses of manganese intensifies the traditional illness, giving the mad cow disease variant the potency to kill younger people. Now all he wants is funding for more research, something that Agriculture Minister Nick Brown says may be ready in this year, but after a scientist has received all work on the subject, unquote. Now, what's of interest is this guy who nobody took seriously, everybody thought he was just a crackerjack, he's being taken very seriously now because virtually all of the information that he has brought forth makes as much sense as any that the government has put forward. And so now it looks like he will get some funding and they will take a look at this. Good for him. Final story here. This comes from Noel Peterson. Grapefruit loaded or leaded or unleaded. In the produce business, getting the first crops of the season to market is so profitable that growers will do almost anything to beat the competition. In Florida, for example, citrus growers pick grapefruits from September to November, a full 2 months earlier than normal, by ripening them with lead arsenate. A combination of lead and arsenic, it is used on 30% of Florida grapefruit crop. The resulting grapefruits contain an average lead level of 170 parts per billion, compared with the new drinking water standard of 15 parts per billion. What's more, residues of inorganic arsenic average 130 parts per billion in fruit and 50 parts per billion in the juice, both of which exceed drinking water standards. Now, lead causes brain damage and mental and physical growth retardation in children. Arsenic is a known carcinogen, causes severe nervous disorders, and is a gastrointestinal, kidney, liver, and blood toxin. The Environmental Protection Agency has been conducting a 10-year special review of the use of lead arsenate. However, results of the study are not expected to be released until the current supply of the toxin has been consumed. Since EPA has been asleep at the wheel, the National Coalition Against the Misuse of Pesticides has been urging consumers not to buy grapefruit until the main crop comes in, which is really in January. It probably wouldn't hurt to let the produce people at your local market know how much you appreciate having been spared the difficulties of knowing your fresh produce have been ripened with lead arsenate. Now, of course, if you buy organic, you don't have that problem. One more reason to buy organic, but for those who don't buy early season produce. It's a problem. That brings up the end of another program. I want to thank you all for listening. Tomorrow, hopefully, I'll be in a studio. I'll be back in New York at the end of the week. And I'm hopeful, if all goes well, on Friday to present the first of a three-part series on my independent investigation of examining the facts surrounding the problems at Pacifica and WBAI. I'm waiting for two pieces of information to come into my hands and two more interviews, and then I feel confident that the information I have at hand is enough to make a very fact-based and solid presentation, the first of the three that will be done. Hopefully that will be on Friday. Have a nice week, everyone, and I'll see you tomorrow.